Marcelo, do you think we've been seduced by the success of science, especially in your discipline of physics, where so many major discoveries have been made over the last century? I mean, do we think we know more about the structure of the universe than we actually do?
I think some people think we know more than we actually do, or some people think that we can know more than we actually can. But I like the notion of seduction. I think that because science has been so successful over the last two centuries to explain so much about the natural world and to really to transform the way we live and the way we think about nature and about our relationship with it, yes, there is a seductive side of it. And some people call it scientism, which would basically mean that science is the only way to make sense of things, and that not just that, but it can make sense of everything. And that's where the danger lies, I think.
In what way is science limited, or is our knowledge limited?
Well, I think there are two ways in which we can immediately show that there are problems with science. Not necessarily bad problems, but simply limitations in the way science actually works. So the first one is that in order to do science, you have to gather data about nature. And in order to do that, our senses are not enough. So what we do is we amplify our senses with instruments. And of course, instruments have the power to completely transform the way we see the world. You know, just think of the microscope and you think of the telescope and what was happening before the invention of these two instruments and how they both transformed completely the way we think about the world. So instruments are absolutely key and have been. And you can even tell the history of science by telling the history of technological innovation, if you want, you know, how the two go hand in hand. However, we have to remember that instruments are not perfect, that every instrument that is built has a range of a range in which it can see things far away or very small things, and it also with a given level of precision, which basically means that instruments can only amplify our vision of nature up to a certain point, and we cannot see beyond that point. Granted, as technology advances, our instruments also advance, but even so, because of the nature in which they operate, there is always going to be a blind spot, so to speak, things that we cannot see.
So you're saying that our knowledge is almost by definition limited to the technological instruments we use. I mean, we can't see beyond them, and we'll keep having new technologies that will reveal new things about the world, but we'll never get the whole picture.
Exactly. I think the whole idea that we can see everything or that our instruments can catch everything is just simply very naive. You know, it's just not looking at the way we actually construct our view of reality, so to speak, you know. And just as a comparison, let's think about this for a second. So Galileo's telescope. So Galileo's telescope, which he didn't invent, but that he used and perfected and he made lenses that were very powerful, at least compared to the original telescopes. And he could see the four bigger moons of Jupiter, and he could see that Saturn had ears. He couldn't really resolve the rings. So he saw things that no one else had seen before, right? And that's just phenomenal. However, nowadays, with, you know, garden variety telescopes that you can buy at Walmart, you can see these things too. And our most powerful telescopes can see remarkable stuff, right? They can go and see galaxies being born billions of light years away. But that does not mean that they can capture the whole story, right? And so the way we do science is a combination of how we gather information from nature and our intuitive deductive power, right? So we create models, we look for symmetry to simplify complex behavior, and we combine these two things and we invent this thing called science. So apart from the limitations from an instrumental perspective, you also have limitations, and these are really the tough ones. We have limitations that come from the way nature itself operates.
What do you mean?
I mean, for example, there are limits in that basically preclude us from understanding more than a certain level. Example, the speed of light, which is the most obvious of them all. So light is incredibly fast, right? 186,000 miles per second. You blink your eye and light can go 7.5 times around the Earth. It's a ridiculously fast speed. You know, but it's not instantaneous, right? So if the sun exploded right now, it would take us about 8 minutes to find out. Granted, it would be the last thing you'd ever know, right? Boom, that's it. But the point is that everything that we see is in the past. You know, if you look at a book, the book is going to be, you're really looking at the book as it were a billionth of a second ago, because that's how long light needs to travel in about the distance, you know, of a few inches from the book to your eye. So the point is that the vision or the construction of reality that we come up with that depends on the speed of light is always looking at the past. So to make this more dramatic, you go into the night sky and you look at things and you're always looking as very much like a time machine. You know, you're looking very much at the past every time you look at the sky. Now, you combine this with the fact that the universe has a finite age. So the universe has 13.8 billion years. That basically means that, you know, that's when time, as we know, it started to tick. So that tells you that light in 13.8 billion years could only travel so far. And that means that we are like fish inside a cosmic bubble of information, which is basically the boundary up to which light could have traveled in this time.
That's fascinating. I mean, you're suggesting then that we can only see the light that can travel over 13.8 billion years, but it's possible that the universe might be much bigger. It could be infinite, but we would never know because we don't have enough light to be able to see that far.
Exactly. So a nice analogy is, you know, when you go to the beach and you look at the horizon, you know, where the sky and the ocean meet, there it seems that the ocean ends, but of course we know it doesn't, you know. And so the idea is somewhat similar. You know, we have this cosmic horizon, this bubble of information that we are within, but the universe may very well continue out there and possibly does continue out there, but we cannot know for sure. And to make it more dramatic, if the universe is infinitely large or even infinitely old, we could also never know for sure, because you can never run an experiment long enough to ascertain that the universe is infinitely old, and you can never receive information from far enough away to make sure the universe is infinitely large. Hmm.
Okay, so there are these fundamental mysteries that probably we'll never be able to crack. I mean, there are just some inherent limitations to how much we can know about the universe, the structure of the universe. Where does that leave us?
So, you know, the way I picture this in this book is to call it the island of knowledge, right? So we have this island of knowledge. It grows. It may shrink because sometimes, you know, you carry the wrong idea for a very long time. For example, the ether, the medium where light propagated, right, that survived for a while and then was shut down by Einstein in 1905. But in any case, the island is growing because clearly we learn more and more about the world. However, as the island grows, it's growing into this ocean of the unknown, basically what we do not know about the world. And there is a boundary, right, the edge of the island. And what's interesting about this metaphor is that as the island grows, the shores of our ignorance are also expanding, which basically means the following, is that as we know more about the world, as we know more about nature, we are equipped to ask new questions, questions that we could never have anticipated before, that can drive us in completely unanticipated directions, so to speak. Examples, again, being the telescope and the microscope. Imagine the excitement of discovering that there is this invisible world filled with life, you know, that you could not see with your naked eye, right? So the point is that as we know more about the world, you know, we learn to ask questions you couldn't have asked before. And on top of that, you have the unknowables, right? So there are questions that, in principle, science is not equipped to answer.
For instance?
And those are, well, for example, is the universe infinite or not? So all we can do is we can infer from data that, yes, within the precision that we can measure today, which is at about 1%, we can say the universe appears to be flat, right? And if it's flat, it would be infinite. But you cannot be sure, because it could just be a giant, giant sphere, you know, because a very, very big sphere, and if you look at a small patch on its surface, it would look flat, and yet it isn't. right? So the point of this, which is kind of very fascinating, is that we could be fooled into believing that our view of the world is the real thing when it really isn't. And the way I use history to illustrate this point, I say, let's compare our vision of the universe now to the vision, say, Christopher Columbus had in 1500, right? So in 1500, so pre-Copernican times, the Earth was sitting, you know, still at the center of creation, and the universe was sort of like a cosmic onion with all these layers, and each one of these layers had a planet circling around, and the Earth was just there, you know, humanity was in the center as well. So there was a hierarchy, if you want, a vertical hierarchy that made sense to people. And it was a finite world. There was the outer sphere was the sphere of the stars, and outside the sphere of the stars was basically the realm of God. And look at that vision that people were convinced was the right thing. And then came Copernicus and shot that down by putting the sun in the center. But yet his vision also had a finite universe. And look how far we moved from even the Copernican view to nowadays, where we have this universe which is expanding. It has a finite age. It may be even part of a giant multiverse. It is a completely different cosmology.
The implication is that 500 years from now, if we're still around, we might look back at people in the early 21st century and would think, they were really primitive. I mean, they hardly knew anything. They were so wrong.
That's exactly right. And I think that's wonderful. You know, there's nothing bad with that. I mean, people feel very threatened, I think, by some of these ideas because they feel like there's a loss of power, you know, that you're basically shooting science down. And I think that's completely the wrong way to look at my message here. You know, my message here is that science is an ongoing process of discovery. You know, it's how we create knowledge. And this creation of knowledge depends very much on the way we can understand the world. And that way we can understand the world depends on the way we evolved as creatures and the tools that we use to do that. And so our universe is really our universe in the sense that is the way we make sense of things.
You know, I've talked to lots of scientists over the years, and when I've sort of posed this question, are there fundamental limits to what we can know? A lot of scientists sort of bristle at that. I mean, they kind of take that as, oh, that's sort of an anti-scientific view of things. That's defeatism. You're giving up. You see that quite differently.
I do, and I would like to turn that completely upside down. So what people consider defeat is because they are thinking, they have this kind of romantic view of science as the conqueror of everything, you know, like, and if science fails, then they fail in their conquer, in the conquest. And I'm saying that is exactly not how you should think about science. You know, science is not here to explain everything, to give answers to everything. Science is part of the human culture, is how we make sense of things. And for that reason, it's fallible. You know, I mean, obviously we can create remarkable machines and we can create remarkable theories, and they are very successful. But at the cutting edge, as we move science forward, you know, we have to come to terms with the fact that it has limitations. So what really irks me is when we have like very famous scientists write books or make public pronouncements stating that we have solved some very fundamental questions about the universe, such as what is the Big Bang singularity or the theory of everything. And that, to me, shows a major ignorance of some basic philosophy, you know.
But the whole search for the theory of everything, that has what has propelled so many famous physicists in recent decades. I mean, that's the sort of the holy grail of physics for a lot of people, is to come up with an all-encompassing theory that will unite all of these sort of disparate parts of physics, and so everything works together.
Me included. I went into physics exactly for that reason. You know, I wanted to work on the theory of everything. I did my PhD on superstring theories, which is sort of the modern incarnation of this theory of everything dream. But, you know, with age and with experience, I came to realize that perhaps that is really not how you should be looking at nature, that that is just the wrong message. That is a very romantic construction that, first of all, comes from a marriage, I think, from a marriage of Platonism, you know, the notion that truth is in the realm of mathematical ideas, and the most beautiful ideas are the more truthful ones. And by beauty here, we mean symmetry. And it's coming with a marriage of this Platonism with the fact that we live in a monotheistic culture, you know, have lived in a monotheistic culture for at least 2,000 years, which tries to find a single cause for everything.
So, right? you're really suggesting there's a religious dimension to this underlying theory of many theoretical physicists.
I think religious, or at least cultural, right? I mean, the idea that one is better, right? The idea that there is this unity. And of course, you know, we call it the universe, we call it university. So we are obviously looking for simplicity in the sense that if we have a disparity of phenomena in nature, you want to try to find symmetry so that you can explain a lot with a little, right? That is the big goal of theoretical physics, right? You look at the world and say, this is very complicated. Let's try to explain all this diversity with a few single ideas. And what's more beautiful than if you have a single idea that explains everything? Everything springs from this common source, right? So it's a very beautiful vision. But then you go and you look at what's going on in reality, right? You look at what have we unified truly in nature, right? And you start looking at examples which are classical examples. For example, Newton's theory of gravity showed that gravitational forces here on Earth and in the cosmos act the same way. So in a sense, that's a unification because it shows that gravity is a universal force that acts across space. So that's great. And then people start to say, but wait, maybe different forces can also be seen as manifestations of a single force. So you have electromagnetism, right? The marriage of electricity and magnetism. And people say, look, in the 19th century, Maxwell showed that these two things really are just undulations of this electromagnetic field, and the field propagates at the speed of light, and then electricity and magnetism are really the same force. That is only true if you look at the equations, and the equations on the left-hand side, the famous Maxwell's equations, the equations on the left-hand side show how the electric and the magnetic field change in space and time. On the right-hand side, it gives you what are the sources of this electricity and magnetism. So, you know, electric charge or a magnet. This perfect symmetry between electricity and magnetism, which is sort of like the big example, right, of unification, is only true if you put all the sources to zero, if you set the right-hand side of Maxwell's equations to zero, which obviously believes, which basically says that's empty space, that's no sources, and that's not nature. So the point is that, yes, there is a driving force to simplify, to unify, and that has served us very well. But when you are carefully looking at how far you have gone with these ideas, you realize they are approximations, that nature really is not as unified as we would like it to be.
You know, it strikes me that you are rather unusual for a physicist. You seem to have a deep philosophical streak, and you certainly write about the philosophers over the centuries. Do you still draw inspiration from them, from the history of philosophy?
Absolutely. You know, I love the fact that my chair here at Dartmouth is called the Appleton Professorship of Natural Philosophy, which is the old name for science, right? I mean, the term scientist is only from the 1830s. Is that recent, you know? And that was sort of like the last, you know, kind of like the last straw, you know, like let's split philosophy and science in a very clear way, and that's what they did. So no more natural philosophy, right?
And there are a lot of physicists today who don't like philosophy at all. I mean, famous physicists like Stephen Hawking and Lawrence Krauss, Neil deGrasse Tyson,
right.
And they've all said very dismissive things about philosophy, basically that we don't need philosophy anymore because we have science. Science has replaced philosophy.
Right, and I think that's a big mistake. I think that does not make any sense whatsoever. In fact, it's these, not so much Neil deGrasse Tyson, but I think that what Hawking and Lawrence Krauss are saying shows how embarrassing it can be when a scientist does not know philosophy and starts to say things like that. And in fact, Lawrence Krauss, you know, got himself into a big imbroglio with this when he wrote his book about the universe coming out of nothing and he says philosophy is dead. And then a philosopher reviewed his book for the New York Times and gave him a real hard time. And that started a whole brouhaha that ended up with Lawrence Krauss writing a sort of explanation that he really doesn't mean that for Scientific American. And the point is that what we are doing, you know, you cannot separate the technical aspects of physics, which is the mathematics, the concepts, from the philosophical conceptual structure of what physics is about. I think whenever you split these two things, you stop being a scientist in the broader sense of the term, and you become a technician. And when you deal with questions of the origin of the universe, or the structure of matter, and what is space and what is time, you just can't be a pure technician. You have to look at your ideas within the context of philosophy.
But the response that you'll get from some of these scientists who you may accuse of scientism is that science is in the business of asking questions where you can get actual answers. There's no point in asking other kinds of questions. It's just, it amounts to navel-gazing. Let's talk about the real world where we can get actual evidence. That's what matters, and that's what science does.
Right, and that's what I do when I wear my physicist cap. You know, so when I'm writing my papers, or when I'm writing my grant proposals, when I have my PhD students, I'm also a technician, you know, and I am doing very hardcore calculations, and I am totally part of that team. And that is perfectly fine, and that's how science is done in practice, right? But when you write books where you try to analyze culturally what science is doing, or explaining to the general public, you know, the reach of science, then I think you do a disservice by only showing science as this kind of like, I am dissociated from culture, I am just solving this problem. And in fact, by the way, I already solved this problem. The problem, the first cause, the problem that has been with us for 3,000 years, piece of cake. It's a quantum vacuum. What the heck? You know, so, and then you say, that is nothing. And that is just not correct, you know, from a conceptual perspective.
So the first cause, meaning sort of what started everything else. In other words, the overarching mystery is, you know, how did the universe begin? And no one knows.
And can science explain that in a final way? And the point that I made is that you cannot, because science operates within very strict parameters. You know, you need to, in order to construct a model where the vacuum has a quantum creation of the universe, so to speak, you have to have a space-time, you have to have the concept of energy, you have to have a whole complex of ideas that you apply to this model, right? And so you can say that within the explanatory powers of science, this is a very nice model of what could have happened, but to proclaim that that's all there is to it is just naive and unnecessary. You know, it's unnecessary. We don't need to be the heroes that do all that, you know, and this sort of declaration of war to other modes of explanation, to me, they just make science into the enemy, and we don't need science to be the enemy of people.
We should talk about quantum physics in more detail. I mean, what happens at the very tiny level, I mean, the level of atoms and electrons and particles and waves and all of that. I mean, things get really strange there, right? I mean, it's very counterintuitive what this says, this level of reality says about the world that we live in.
Right. I'm so glad you asked that, because I spent quite some time writing about this. So what is it that we call reality, right? So and the easy answer is, hey, I just look around and I see and I hear and I touch, and with those feelings with those sensations, I can actually construct a model of the world. And in that idea, you are immediately making this assumption that you can be objective about the nature of the world, meaning you can separate yourself from the rest of everything, and you can say, yep, I can see, and from seeing this separately, I can create an image of what reality is. And that has been the way what we call classical physics has operated, you know, from Galileo all the way to the end of the 19th century. So when quantum physics comes about, this notion of detachment is thrown upside down. And the reason is that when you look at the world of very small objects, you know, molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, you cannot detach the observer from what is being observed. The act of observing, so to speak, create a sort of bound between the observer and the observed that you cannot separate.
Can you explain that?
Yeah.
People say that, but it's a hard idea to grasp, that somehow that the actual act of observation or the act of measurement, to some degree, actually creates the reality.
Yes, it is a very strange idea. And the notion is the following. When you want to see something in a microscope, right, what you're really doing is you're passing light through a lens, and that is amplifying whatever you're seeing. And this light is hitting the microbe or the cell, whatever it is, and bouncing back and getting back to your eye with the information about the cell. So in order to see, you're basically shooting light at that object. Now, light is a wave. And so in order to see something, you want to make sure that this wave, and every wave, you know, has these crests that separate them. We call them the wavelength, which is the distance between two crests of a wave, right? So if you have a wave with a very large wavelength and the object that you want to see is very small, the wave is just going to pass by it and won't even care, like a big wave, you know, a tidal wave looking at a little stone. Who cares about the stone, right? So in order to use the wave to locate the stone, you need a wave that has wavelengths of similar size to that stone. So now you take that down to the atom. And now you're talking about light, which has a very small wavelength. Turns out, as Einstein has shown to us, light has energy, which is inversely proportional to the wavelength. So the smaller the wavelength, the higher the energy. So if you want to see something very small, you need a very small wavelength, which means you need light of very high energy. So now what happens? You shoot that light of very high energy to an atom, because an atom is very small. And because it has high energy, it kicks the atom away when you want to see it. So basically, the act of trying to see the atom messes things up, because as you're trying to see it, you're pushing it away from you, right? And so you can never be precise about where the atom is. And the more energy you put into the wave, the more of a punch you're packing, you know, into the thing you want to see, and the less precise you are. That is the uncertainty principle, right? That's the idea that you cannot be exactly precise about the position and the velocity of a very small object.
Okay, so that says a lot about sort of our problems of measuring something. I mean, the act of measuring actually, to some degree, creates what we are measuring. But still, reality exists whether we're looking at it or not, right?
Well, there you go. So then comes the mathematical apparatus that you use to study these things, okay? And that's where life gets a little complicated, because it turns out that in, say, Newton's physics, right, that people study in high school, you have an equation that tells you, look, I have a little block that is moving at a certain speed, and the equation is about the speed of that block. When you go to quantum mechanics, the equation is not about the electron, about the atom anymore. It doesn't describe the thing that you are studying. It describes the probability that a measurement is going to see that thing with a given energy in a given place. So it's a completely different way of explaining nature, so to speak. So instead of saying, here's my equation for the electron, you say, here's my equation for the probability that when I make a measurement, I'm going to see the electron with a certain energy. And that's the difference, is about making a measurement in order to determine what the energy is. So if you're a purist, like the old guys were, you know, Bohr and Pauli and a bunch of others, you can say that the act of making the measurement is what's giving reality to the electron, because before, you couldn't say anything about the electron whatsoever. You can't say where it is. You can't say what energy it has. Only when you measure it, you can make these statements with a given probability. So it's a very different way of thinking. So reality becomes dependent on the way you measure it.
Well, and it seems there are some profound philosophical implications of what we have learned so far about reality at the quantum level. I mean, for instance, this whole bizarre idea of quantum entanglement, that two particles that have been connected and then somehow get separated instantly respond to each other, even if they are at opposite ends of the universe. I mean, that's just totally strange.
it is totally strange. And believe me, all physicists also think it's totally strange. I don't think anybody is at ease with such an idea. You know, Einstein used to call it the spooky action at a distance, right? It looks like a ghostly synchronicity kind of thing.
And Einstein did not like this. I mean, this was not the world that he had hoped to see.
Oh, he did not like it at all, because it implies in something we call non-locality, right? The idea that, so, you know, in a normal set of circumstances, in order for something to happen, you need a local cause, right? So if you want to, since we just had the World Cup, if you want to kick a ball into a goal, you got to kick it into the goal. And there is a cause and effect relationship, which is local, right? What happens with these quantum mechanical systems where you can create a pair of entangled particles, you know, just think of, say, two electrons. One is spinning to the left, the other one is spinning to the right, okay? So that's sort of and you put them close to one another, you create an entangled pair. Then you move them far away, and it turns out that if you measure, and you don't know exactly which one of them, when they move away from their source, is going up or which one is going down. Let me say that again. So you don't know exactly when they move from the source, which one is going up and which one is going down. But when you make a measurement, you see that the one you measured is going up, you are 100% sure that the other guy is down.
Even if that other one is a million miles away.
Even if the other one is a million miles away, and even if you're making these these measurements instantaneously. And that is just really weird, because that's basically saying that this pair is an entity that has some sort of unity that remains even when separated by space, by spatial distances. And that is just very counterintuitive. What is this thing, right? And indeed, it happens, and it's very present. And Anton Zeilinger in Vienna, you know, he's a wizard of these amazing experiments that probe this effect. And he has been doing remarkable things. And what he's trying to find out, which I think is a very important point, is how far can you push this quantum weirdness into the classical realm, right? Because one thing is to say these things happen to electrons or to atoms or small molecules, but what happens when you start to approach bigger things? I mean, because from the perspective of quantum physics, okay, the world is quantum mechanical. I am quantum mechanical, you are quantum mechanical, the universe is quantum mechanical, but clearly we are not having these non-local behaviors. We cannot be in two places at once like other particles could. So something goes on from the very small to the large where this quantum weirdness goes away.
Although, right? I will say that there are some people who have tried to draw some, I guess you could say, spiritual implications from these kinds of things. I mean, the notion, going back to Carl Jung, of synchronicity, that, you know, something bizarre happens and you suddenly know about it, and it's as if it would explain some paranormal phenomena. These people talk about quantum physics.
It's true. You know, Jung and Pauli, Wolfgang Pauli, one of the greatest physicists ever, they had a lot of correspondence, because Pauli had some serious anxiety issues and dreams. And so this notion of synchronicity and its relation to physics, Pauli and Jung wrote up to each other about. Problem is, Steve, that when people start to extrapolate these ideas of quantum physics into the mind and into paranormal phenomena, you really go into very fishy territory. Because what we know is that those effects, these entanglement effects, tend to be very fragile. That means that you can sustain these things as long as these particles are isolated from the environment, that is from the heat, from electromagnetic radiation, from turbulence in the air. So when you start to think about this and you start to put these effects into our heads, right, our brains are very hot and a very turbulent environment. So it is very far-fetched to think that entanglement can have any large effect in the brain.
On consciousness, you're saying that's a fool's errand to try to find the connections between quantum entanglement and consciousness.
Oh, let's not say a fool's errand, because, you know, the last thing I want to be is, I don't want to shoot down possibilities, you know, but I would say that it would be a very hard one to prove. And you know, Roger Penrose, one of our greatest scientists, you know, he has been trying to develop this notion that there are structures called microtubules, which happen to be little tubes that offer the skeletal support of cells. And he thinks, with a guy called Stuart Hameroff, they have been trying to sell the idea that these tubules can have quantum entanglement effects that have something to do with how unconsciousness ideas float around and whatever. A lot of people have shot them down, but they seem to kind of keep coming back. You know, it's one of these things. But let me say that because there is so much mystery about how we understand things and how, especially how we understand how the brain works, it's good to keep an open mind.
Well, I want to follow up on this, though, because you write about your early fascination with sort of the connection in particular between Eastern mysticism and quantum physics. And this is back when you were a graduate student in physics. And in fact, you were very taken by Fritjof Capra's best-selling book, The Tao of Physics, you know, this huge bestseller back in the 1970s. And you actually contacted him to see if you could work with him. And that did not work out. So, I mean, obviously there was something there for you.
Absolutely. I can say that I was a very, you know, I grew up in Rio, and in Brazil we have this syncretic combination of Christianity and the African religions. It's a very mystical place. And you see this in the streets every Monday morning, people like light candles on crossroads and black chickens and cigars for the gods. And then they put a cross in the middle of it. It's really weird how they combine the two things. But the point is that, yes, I grew up in this kind of environment, and I was very spiritual, and I was interested in Taoism and Eastern and yoga, etc., before I was interested in physics. So one day, after I started physics, I was walking around the library at my university in Rio, and I saw this book called The Tao of Physics, and it just blew me away. I was 18 years old, and Fritjof Capra had come up with these ideas, and I had made a list of possible overlaps between special relativity and Zen Buddhism, and there was the book talking about these things. I was like amazed, and that did take me, you know, by surprise, and I thought, aha, so there may be a connection, and it was a driving notion for me for many years, including going to grad school in England, as you remarked. And nowadays, however, I think very differently of the relationship between religions and science.
Are you religious at all today?
No, I'm not. But I'm also not an atheist. I call myself an agnostic. To be honest with you, I think atheism is inconsistent with the scientific method. And I can tell you why if you want me to.
Sure. Why is atheism inconsistent with science?
Well, it's basically, this is going to make, you know, Richard Dawkins may never hear this, but if he did, he'd be really upset. But essentially, the idea is, it's an essay I never wrote, but one day I probably will, is the idea that atheism is based on faith, right? Because it's making an absolute statement without any empirical validation whatsoever, right? So atheism says God or gods do not exist, period. How do you know? I don't, but they don't exist. That kind of position is completely inconsistent with the scientific method, because in order to make a statement, you have and support that statement, you have to have some empirical validation. And the difficulty with religious faith is you can say, I don't see any evidence of God or gods, but that doesn't disprove that there can be some God or gods. You see, the fact that we don't have an evidence, or as Carl Sagan liked to say, right? I mean, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, applies here if you want to be strict about empirical validation. So that's why atheism is really not consistent with the scientific method. Agnosticism, on the other hand, is, because basically what you're saying is that, look, I don't see any evidence, but I cannot shoot it down because I don't have any evidence to the contrary.
Okay, so you call yourself an agnostic. You say that you are not religious anymore. Would you describe yourself as spiritual?
Absolutely. I think I'm a very spiritual person. And every time on Sundays when I go run my trails in the mountains here of New Hampshire, I think of people going to their temple, and I say, here I am going to my temple. Which is just being close to nature. So I think that a lot of the science, the drive for me to be a scientist and to explore these fundamental questions of knowledge that we talked about here today comes from a very spiritual connection with nature.
Why do you call that spiritual? I mean, why not just say you're a scientist, you're trying to understand how the world works, that's what science is all about. What's spiritual about that?
Because I think that if you just say I'm a scientist and I'm just trying to understand how the world works, you sound like you could be just a shoemaker, you know, and you could be just building shoes because I want to know how a shoe can work and fit in your shoes and your feet better. I think that there are different kinds of scientists, and the vast majority of scientists are the ones that indeed are working on very applied problems, couldn't care less about spiritual questions or questions about foundational questions about the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of matter. They are trying to figure out better microchips, or they're trying to build machines that can perform better, or et cetera, et cetera. And so, or even condensed matter physicists that in the vast majority are trying to study materials and the property of materials. They're really not doing it because the way I'm doing it. And so, yes, there are all kinds of people. And then on the other hand, on the other extreme, you have scientists who are very religious people, right? And they say that the more Muslims and Jews and Christians, and they say that the more they understand the universe, the more justified they are in understanding the glory of the God they believe in, right? And I think I stand kind of in the middle as being a person that does not believe in supernatural causes in the universe, but on the other hand, believe in the beauty and sort of the mystery of our existence. And to me, that mystery, and I'm sounding very much like Einstein here, you know, is essentially very spiritual and very religious, without the need for some sort of hierarchy that is based on a supernatural faith.
Well, let me try to put this in the context of why we as a human species are here, or any species on Earth. It would seem from a strictly scientific standpoint, we're just a cosmic accident, where we're kind of this insignificant speck in the universe without any meaning. Is there any reason to think of us any differently?
Yes. When people talk about science, you know, at least people of mostly religious of inclinations, they say, you know, these scientists, they are horrible people, you know, because basically what they're doing is they're destroying our faith in the mysterious. That the more we understand about the world, the more insignificant we become, right? So before Copernicus, we're like the center of everything, you know, God's image, et cetera, et cetera. There comes Copernicus. Earth becomes a planet. We are not the center anymore. And then the more we move on into that set, we become less and less important, right? The sun is not the center. And then the solar system is just one amongst hundreds of billions on this galaxy alone. And so, and then the matter of the universe, right? We didn't really talk about this today, but, you know, we are surrounded by mystery in the sense that 95% of the stuff that fills the universe is completely unknown to us, right? You have 25% of this dark matter and 70% of dark energy, two enormous mysteries right now in front of us.
And we don't really have a clue what those two things are.
We really do not have a clue. You know, I mean, there are like all sorts of indications. It could be this, it could be that. But in particular, the case for dark matter, which is closer to us in the sense that we can make experiments that measure or supposedly try to find it, have been completely negative, you know. And in fact, the more we look for it, the less we seem to be able to find of any of it. And so it's really weird. But the point I was trying to make is that so only 5% of the matter in the universe is the stuff that we are made of, you know, atoms. So we really seem to matter very little, right? That's the notion. And then, yes, you know, life appeared accidentally, evolution, mutations. What the heck? You know, why are we here? I mean, what's the point of all this? And so here comes my notion, which I call human centrism. Put this all upside down, and you look at it in the following way. The universe is a very hostile place to life. Yes, there may be life in other places, but clearly it's going to be rare. Right? Otherwise, there'll be something Mars, there'll be something somewhere else, and we are not finding any evidence of it in our solar system. Maybe there is something in Europa. I don't want to shoot that down either because we don't have evidence. But the point is that life is not ubiquitous. You know, it may be out there, and if it is out there, it is mostly going to be simple life, like bacteria stuff, because if you look at the history of life here on Earth, life has been around here for 3.5 billion years out of 4.5 billion years. And of roughly 500 million years, only the last 500 million years, life was complicated. Before that, for 3 billion years, it was just a bunch of amoeba, actually, you know, blue-green algae, they're called. So the point is that if there is life out there, most probably it's going to be simple unicellular life. So when you start to study how the heck life went from simple cells to complex cells to multicellular to mammals to intelligent mammals, you realize there are all sorts of incredibly difficult barriers to overcome. And so the fact that we are these molecular machines on this isolated planet in the middle of nowhere, they are capable of asking these questions about existence. That makes us very important indeed, because as far as we know, there may be other intelligences out there, who knows, but as far as we know right now, we are alone. And if we are alone and we are able to think about this, we are very important to the future of life in the universe. In fact, we have the moral obligation, the moral imperative of protecting life. So suddenly we become much more than just nothing. We become extremely important in the big scheme of things just because we are so rare.
We're special because we're rare. We're so unusual.
Exactly.
Huh. Do you think we will see a new physics? You know, just as Einstein more than 100 years ago came along and kind of rewrote the laws of physics, would you guess that we'd see some brand new revolutions in physics in the coming decades?
I hope so, and I would like to say I'm sure we will, because I think that the way things are going right now in theoretical physics, at least at the high energies frontier, you know, particle physics and cosmology, we are getting, we're basically stuck on some real big questions, you know, about, as I mentioned, dark matter, dark energy. There is the issue of information loss in a black hole, the issue of quantum entanglement that we talked about. And these questions to me are basically the precursor of something else that is going to come up. And I'm just looking forward to what's going to come next.
Hmm. So given all that you have said about how science is inherently limited in some ways, I mean, it will always be limited to some degree, for instance, by the equipment that we use to look at the universe, by limitations like the speed of light, you know, we can only see so far. Given these inherent limitations to our quest to understand reality, where does that leave us in terms of questions about certainty, about knowledge? I mean, what's a healthy response to how we should approach the world?
The healthy response is this, is that the fact that there are limits to knowledge, that there are obstacles to our understanding of nature, should not be seen as the end of the story. It should be seen as the beginning of a new story, because essentially obstacles are not the walls that you cannot go through. Obstacles are opportunities for growth. It is when you find an obstacle that you're able to create strategies to transcend it in some way. So to me, identifying knowledge and the limits of identifying the limits of knowledge is actually a liberating experience, because we take off our shoulders the weight of carrying this truth with capital T, you know, which is really a burden, right? So what we do have is a narrative. We create an ongoing narrative of the world that we call science, and it's changing, and the views of nature are changing, and nature offers us obstacles, and we try to go around them. For example, as in mathematics, you have the incompleteness theorem of Gödel and others that basically seem to say that, oh, the buck stops here, but on the other hand, what you do is you dribble that as a good player, and you find different ways of creating new knowledge. So to me, identifying limits is actually the first step to transcending them.
Well, it also sounds like you're saying that a healthy response to our limitations and what we know, and in fact, maybe the intellectually responsible response is often to say, I don't know, and that's okay.
Yes, of course. So embrace ignorance, you know, and not certainty. So it's okay to not know. And I think that's just fine. You know, so if there are some answers that we cannot understand because of the way the questions are formulated and the way science operates, that is not a failure of science at all. There are other ways in which we can make meaning of the world and of mystery without the scientific method. And so it's okay not to know everything.
That's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.